Once in Kiev, we were taken to the Neurosurgical Research Institute, a huge and ugly building with the endless corridors that are the curse of all large hospitals. The corridors were dark and poorly lit. On the walls one could see serious displays of the triumphs of Soviet neurosurgery, with grainy black-and-white photographs of heroic men in the tall white chef's hats that Soviet surgeons used to wear, interspersed with hammers and sickles, red stars, inspirational slogans, and photographs of scenes from the Great Patriotic War, as the Russians call the Second World War. But everything from the building itself to the pictures on the walls and the stale air which smelt of cheap tobacco and some odd, sickly-smelling disinfectant felt tired and faded. We were ushered into the office of Academician Ramadanov, an old, imposing and very eminent man and the director of the institute. He was tall, with a large head and a mane of white hair, and he wore a high-collared white coat, buttoned round his throat. He looked, however, as tired and faded as the corridors, and was in fact to die a few months later. After the usual introductions, all conducted through an interpreter, we sat down round the long table in his office.
"Why have you come here?" he asked angrily. "As tourists? To amuse yourselves by seeing all our problems? This is a very difficult time for us."
We tried to answer diplomatically and talked of friendship and professional collaboration and international cooperation. He looked unconvinced, and he was, of course, entirely right. We were then shown round the famous institute by one of his assistants.
"This is the largest neurosurgical hospital in the world," we were told. "There are 8 departments and 5 floors and 400 beds."
I was amazed. My own hospital, one of the largest neurosurgical units in Britain, had only 50 beds. We traipsed up and down the stairs and along corridors and visited each identical department in turn. We started on the ground floor.
"This is the department of posterior fossa tumours," we were told.
As we came through the doors, the staff came out to meet us, to shake hands and to be photographed with us. I was told all about the wide range of operations that went on in the department, although any detailed questions on my part were usually met with rather vague answers. We went through exactly the same ritual in the 7 other departments. When I asked if we could see the operating theatres, I was told that they were being redecorated and were closed. We saw scarcely a single patient. We delivered our lectures. The few questions afterwards showed a complete and utter lack of understanding of what we had been trying to explain. We returned to our hotel. As with the hotel in Moscow, there were beautiful young women to be seen everywhere. I was told they were not professional prostitutes, but respectable women desperately trying to make some money. One session with a Western businessman was, at that time, worth more than a whole month's income. Embarrassed and fascinated, we made our way shyly past them and retreated to one of our rooms to drink duty-free whiskey, confused and shocked by the surreal discrepancy between what we had seen and what we had been told as we toured the hospital. The next day, I was taken to the emergency hospital on the eastern side of the city. I had asked to see how trauma was managed, and my guides, a little reluctantly, had agreed to take me. We arrived in the late afternoon. The light was starting to fade. The hospital was 10 stories high, apparently with 800 beds. It was only 10 years old, but already looked derelict. We approached it through a wasteland of broken buildings and those gigantic, incomprehensible pipes that always seemed to surround Soviet buildings, on which pure white snow was starting to fall from a leaden sky. At one side there was a large and ramshackle open-air market with battered, zinc-covered huts displaying rather sad little collections of cheap cosmetics and vodka. Decrepit Lada and Moskvich and Volga cars were parked in utter disorder. Everything was grey, colourless and drab, in the way that only Soviet cities could be. Collecting the illegal rent paid by the market traders was, I subsequently heard, an important part of the hospital director's job and a useful source of income for the officials of the city's health administration. The electricity supply had failed, and much of the hospital was in pitch darkness. The whole place stank of ammonia. The hospital had run out of disinfectants, and only ammonia was available for cleaning. The building seemed almost uninhabited. I was taken to one of the dark operating theatres, a huge, cavernous place, with a large window looking out onto what appeared to be a bomb site. Flurries of snow could be seen there, caught in the dim light from the window of the theatre. An operation was going on. A surgeon was operating on a paralysed man, paralysed from the neck down in an accident some years previously, I was told. There was a small tray of battered instruments beside him that looked as though they came from a scrapyard. The patient was lying on his side and was partially covered with old curtains with a faded floral pattern. The surgeon had inserted several large needles into his spine and was injecting cold saline through them into the spinal canal. This was, apparently, supposed to stimulate the spinal cord to recover. The reflex movements in the paralysed man's legs that the injections produced were greeted with cries of excitement and seen as evidence that the treatment was working. While I was walking along one particularly dark and dismal corridor, a young man came hurrying up to me like an enthusiastic spaniel. It was the surgeon I had seen operating on the paralysed man.
"This is your surgical department," he announced in broken English. "There are three departments of emergency neurosurgery. I am Igor Kurilets, director of spinal emergency department."
I expected the long and tedious description to continue. I was quickly becoming familiar with the litany of departments and beds and achievements with which one was greeted when one visited a Ukrainian hospital, and expected to be reassured that Ukrainian emergency spinal neurosurgery was the equal of the world, if not better.
"Everything terrible here," he said.
I liked Igor immediately. Apart from academician Romadanov, he was the only doctor I met on my first visit who seemed able to admit openly that the medical situation in Ukraine, at least in neurosurgery, was dire. The Soviet Union had excelled at producing guns and rockets, but failed miserably at producing decent health care. Although there were impressive-sounding research institutes and thousands of professors, the reality was of poorly trained doctors and poorly equipped hospitals that were often little better than what one might find in the Third World. The Soviet Union, it used to be said, is Upper Volta with rockets. Upper Volta, as it was then called, being the poorest country in Africa. Most of the doctors I met, driven by a mixture of shame, patriotism, envy and embarrassment, felt compelled to deny this, and did not welcome people like Igor, who dared to point out the emperor's lack of clothes. Soviet culture had never encouraged criticism, and had gone to great lengths to isolate its citizens from the rest of the world. Despite the fall of the Soviet Union, newly independent Ukraine still had the same leaders as in the past, but the country and its people were suddenly exposed to the outside world and the huge gulf that had developed between Western and Eastern European medicine. Before I left Kiev, after this first visit, I attended a meeting at the Ministry of Health. An expressionless, florid-faced bureaucrat, the umpteenth secretary of some umpteenth department of this or that, walked round the long table, handing out his business card, where his umpteen titles were all duly listed. The more important bureaucrats, I had noticed, would have so many titles and appointments that more than one card was needed to list them all. This man was only a one-card bureaucrat, so clearly not too important. I soon lost interest in what was being said. Besides, it all had to be slowly translated, which made it doubly tedious. The room, panel,